When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Most Hong Kong residents nowadays only have to worry about a wandering boar or an aggressive monkey in their day-to-day lives. But for much of its history, those living in the British colony were worried about a very different form of wildlife, the South China tiger. Not that their British overlords always believed them, as John Saeki notes in his book, The Last Tigers of Hong Kong, True Stories of Big Cats That Stalked Britain's Chinese Colony, published by Blacksmith Books. Police officers, civil servants, and journalists often dismissed sightings as a case of mistaken identity by confused locals, until authorities saw tigers with their own eyes, in which case it became a much more serious problem. John Saeki runs the graphics desk in the Hong Kong office of the international newswire Agence France-Presse. He spends his working days writing, designing, and editing maps, charts, information, graphics on world news. He is also the author of the novel The Tiger Hunters of Tayo. Today, John and I talk about the tiger and its many sightings, rumored and confirmed, in the now lost rural communities of Hong Kong. So, John, thanks so much for joining me today on the Asian Review Books podcast. You know, let's start with the South China tiger. What do we know about it, and did it differ from other tigers?
Well, thanks very much for inviting me, Nicholas. It's always good to talk about tigers. The South China tiger, which features in my book, was recognized as one of the nine main subspecies of tigers, which had been recognized throughout most of the 20th century. What's interesting now is that the IUCN in 2017 have revised their subspecies categories to separate them into continental and Sunda Island tigers. Continental basically means all the tigers except for the Sumatran tiger. So the South China tiger is one of those. The differences between the subspecies were very subtle, and there seems to be a lot of evidence that recognized subspecies did interbreed when their territories overlapped. And as the 2017 ruling would imply, I think they're better seen as kind of different breeds, like, for example, like dog breeds, rather than distinct species. But China is the place where the oldest remains of tigers have been discovered at more than 2 million years old, further north than the heartland of the South China tigers, so closer towards Xi'an. And so many people consider that China is a sort of suitable place to look at as the origin of the tiger species. The South China tiger is now classed as functionally extinct, according to sort of international groups like the WHO and IUCN. Although the government of China does still have an official program that's hoping to revive the species from the few sort of captives that have been identified as South China. So that's the South China tiger.
So how did tigers actually get into Hong Kong? You know, the border between China and British Hong Kong was largely meaningless, at least from the tigers' point of view. So how do they actually kind of cross the border and get into the territory?
So I think that basically they walked or they swam. I think the land border was certainly porous for both animals and humans. The degree to which it was porous, I think, depended on what was going on in the territory. There'd be certain periods when the British would have guarded it a lot more carefully, and other periods when things were more relaxed. Tigers being almost invisible much of the time, they wouldn't have found it very difficult to slip past human efforts on the land. The swimming abilities, I think, are less well appreciated, just as the swimming abilities of Hong Kong wild boars are. There was a period in the early 2000s in Hong Kong when the public golf course at Kau Sai Cha was having big problems because of boars digging up the fairways at night. Well, that's an island. At first, people found it difficult to understand how that was happening until they realized that the boars were actually swimming over from Sai Kung. So we have the swimming boars, and certainly we've got the tigers. And you can find several instances of tigers swimming in my book. And also, actually, these days, all you need to do is sort of check on YouTube and you can find examples of tigers swimming and swimming very well.
So, you know, what did local Chinese communities think of the tiger, both in Hong Kong and across the border in southern China? You know, did they think of it as a threat, as a pest, or as, you know, something bigger, something more symbolic?
I think both. There's certainly plenty from sort of Chinese tiger mythology. There was a lot of work that was done by the American researcher Chris Coggins, who also features in my book quite a bit, who made a record of how the tiger was very much revered and very much part of folklore and myth, and was seen as a deity in many parts of southern China. But at the same time, there was a real awareness of the danger of living close to a tiger, especially if a tiger gained the habit of hunting people, which from time to time the records showed that it was something that happened. So I think they were held in awe and at the same time with a fair bit of fear. And there was a lot of practical folklore as well, I think, that I've heard passed on by Hong Kong friends. And what one of the classics is to run downhill if you see a tiger. Now, I read about this. It kept coming up in the writings of Harry Caldwell, another person featured in my book. And he was talking about villagers he'd meet in South China in the 1910s, early 20s. And they all said, if you see a tiger, run downhill. Then a Hong Kong friend of mine asked her mother about her experiences of growing up in the New Territories in the 1950s. And one of the things that her mother came back to with was, if you see a tiger, you have to run downhill. So there was certainly an awareness amongst the locals that the tigers were around. I think depending on how they lived, of course, whether it was very rural or in the middle of the city, but in the rural areas, I think there was an awareness. One of my favorite stories about that came from a court case in Hong Kong when a European lawyer quizzed a witness from Lantau on her whereabouts at a certain time. And she explained that she was up on the hills with her cattle as there had been a report of a tiger. This completely baffled the lawyer, and he asked her why on earth she would stick around if there was a tiger. And she was just as baffled by his ignorance and said, well, obviously, I was up there to protect my animals. So I think there was definitely a different awareness amongst the sort of rural local people compared to the sort of British overlords.
So it's interesting you mentioned Harry Caldwell, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit in my notes here. But if your book kind of has a central character, it's probably him. You know, he's a missionary, he's a tiger hunter, using I guess the power of tiger hunting to spread the word of God. But I guess who was he, and what was he doing hunting tigers in South China?
Yeah, well, I dedicated a chapter on Harry Caldwell because I think it was really interesting. And although his exploits all took place across the border, I think it's very relevant to understanding the Hong Kong tiger, because the Hong Kong tiger wasn't indigenous to Hong Kong. It was they were the South China tigers that were just wandering in and out of Hong Kong. And no one knew them better, certainly in the sort of English-speaking world, than Harry Caldwell. The reason for that is that he was already a hunter in the United States before he was posted to China for his missionary work. And at first, he didn't expect to be hunting tigers. In fact, he didn't even know that there were tigers in South China. He brought his rifle just as because it was his hobby, it's what he did. But he didn't think it was related to his missionary work until the people that he was trying to convert to Christianity noticed that he was quite a keen hunter and started coming up to him saying, look, you know, if you're going to do that, we've got something useful for you. We've got these deadly tigers in our neighborhood, and it would really help us if you could go after them. And so he set about finding out about more about this, and met his first tigers very near to the area where he was doing his missionary work. It was urgent for him to do something about this, because he built a church after he'd converted a handful of people, but they were afraid to leave their houses to come to the church because there happened to be a tiger in the area. So he went out, hunted his first tiger, and there is a long story about that that's in my book, which I won't go into now, but it involves the British consul in Amoy, who himself didn't believe there were tigers very, very nearby. But then that was the beginning, and then he carried on hunting, and what he discovered was that it was doing a lot of a service to the community, where people were genuinely afraid of dangerous tigers, and B, it had an amazing success impact on his conversion to Christianity, because people started to believe that his God must be really, really powerful if it can get the tiger gods. So in doing this, then Harry came to know the tiger very, very well. And according to his son, John, Harry's work became very important in identifying the South China tiger as a distinct subspecies at the time. And he spent many hours observing tigers. He would go and sit in a tiger's lair waiting for a tiger to return from a hunt and watch it eat its meal and study how it behaved, mother and cubs, and had the whole setup of the tiger lair until then, of course, he'd eventually shoot one. So it was his intimate knowledge of the tigers made him really interesting, I think, to help us understand what type of an animal was coming into Hong Kong.
So you mentioned the British consul, and that leads me to my next question, which is, you know, you noted several points, both, I guess, in Hong Kong and Southern China, that the British were often, I'm trying the best way to say this, you know, that they always felt like there was no way such a majestic animal like the tiger would ever deign to live in such a place as Hong Kong until they saw it with their own eyes, you know. I guess I wonder if you might kind of talk a bit more about the British attitudes towards the tiger and how they dealt with, I guess, how they viewed rumored and then confirmed kind of tiger sightings in Hong Kong.
Yeah, I mean, I think I personally find it quite interesting, that whole sort of dynamic between the sort of local reports and the skepticism. To a certain extent, I can't really explain why a certain group of people thought one thing and another didn't, but I have my own sort of conjecture. I think, for starters, you mentioned about the sort of the mystique of the tiger, and I think it comes down to quite sort of tangible characteristics. Like, it was just based, the tiger just is such a sheer sort of powerful and beautiful animal, is a real supreme predator, that, you know, without weapons, humans have little chance against the tiger on a one-to-one confrontation. And we're not in a position to really argue with that sort of power. And then you add to that its speed and agility, and you've got a superpower, and then sprinkle in a bit of magic, like its ability to make itself invisible almost at will, and you've got something that's almost supernatural. And I think that seems to be taken across different cultures, and the British had their way of taking it. My impression is that Hong Kong just wasn't considered to be the type of place that held awesome wildlife. Partly the landscape. I think it was Palmerston that noted that it was completely deforested and, you know, a bit of a wasteland. The tigers of India seem to appear from lush jungles with all the mythology that was in the jungles. Any hunt that took place would be a huge affair and a demonstration of power with, you know, hundreds of locals that are turned into jungle beaters that bring the tigers out into the open with powerful sort of overlords sitting on the backs of elephants and shooting at the tigers. And Hong Kong didn't seem like the arena for that sort of event to take place. And that's the sort of, that's the conjecture that comes to me from reading the voice of skepticism that's so apparent in the news articles of the early 20th century. Sorry, I think I've just run dry.
Well, no, I mean, but I think, you know, let's talk about the, I mean, there are two confirmed tiger killings. I mean, sorry, two confirmed tiger killed tigers, I mean, during Hong Kong's history. And I think there's one in the 40s, but I would like to talk about the first one, which is the one in 1915, where I think the tiger that was responsible for killing two policemen. And I wonder if you might talk a bit about that particular event, about the 1915 tiger and how Hong Kong reacted to its presence and to it, you know, killing two policemen.
Yep. And that is the most famous tiger incident. And there's a photograph that was preserved from after the tiger was killed, which people might have seen. So the 1915 tiger came about in March of that year. 2 months earlier, in January, PC Ernest Goucher of Shangshui Police Station had already been informed that there was a tiger in the area when a local farmer reported that his pony had been eaten. And Goucher went out looking at that time but didn't find anything. And then 2 months later, the beginning of March, so people came in with a report about a death. Now, unfortunately, I found little information about who or possibly more than one person had been killed. But what we hear about is Goucher and his friend, who was a colleague from a different police station, who was on a visit. They went out with light, small revolvers and a party of Chinese officers who were only armed with poles. And they got to a village called Leung Yuk Tao. And so a group of children told them very excitedly that that tiger was in the bushes nearby. So Goucher decided to wait for backup. Apparently there was a party of Indian police officers on their way with carbine rifles. And so they waited in the village. But according to the daily press, one of the Chinese officers got impatient and he lobbed a bit of soil into the bushes, which provoked a tiger that was said to be the size of a China pony to jump out at the party. I find this quite interesting because although there's been numerous tiger reports in Hong Kong, there's not really so many tiger attacks. But this one, which was obviously being hunted by a group of armed people, you know, jumped out. And I think there must have been an element of self-defense in the tiger who was aware of what was going on. And it jumped straight onto Goucher and just tossed him about like a shuttlecock, somebody described. Even though he was a big lad, that was more than 6 foot tall. And he was injured pretty badly, sort of flesh torn on his back and in his loins. And but he was alive and he was transported down to Kowloon and to Hong Kong Island, and he was put into hospital and he survived for 4 days. Apparently at first he was doing all right. Meanwhile, the Indian officers arrived at the scene of the tiger and they went looking. They spent a good few hours looking for this tiger and they couldn't find any trace of it. It had completely melted away into the bush, and the party were about to turn back when the tiger then attacked them. Again, I think that's interesting because we don't really have that very often in Hong Kong at all, or basically virtually no other reports. And this time it was the an Indian officer, Rutan Singh, who was the target of the Tigers' attack, and he was killed outright immediately. Gaucha died 4 days later. And what I find interesting is that, you know, perhaps he would have survived if antibiotics had been available to him. But he was at least sort of 20 years too early for that.
So, you know, one thing that struck me on reading your book, and it's one of these things that I always knew in theory, but it was kind of hard to, you know, don't, like, until you actually kind of see it described, it's kind of hard to really visualize, like, how much of Hong Kong was countryside and how much of it kind of remained countryside until, you know, pretty late in its history. I think a lot of the new territories doesn't really get developed until certainly, I think, like the 60s and 70s. So, I mean, so we talk about kind of these villages and these farms and these rural communities that at least the British at times, at least at the beginning, seem to perceive as somewhat lawless. This is just kind of strange, kind of as someone who lives in Hong Kong and thinking of the new territories, anything other, just kind of like, oh, it's country parks and big towns. So, I mean, could you actually talk about kind of what rural Hong Kong was like at this time? What were the new territories like, kind of throughout much of the period that you're writing about?
Well, I think it's worth looking at the population growth. So it was only sort of during the wartime that the Hong Kong population kind of hit the sort of million mark. And now we've got well over 7 million people in Hong Kong. And the main sort of urban concentration of Hong Kong was Hong Kong Island itself and Kowloon. Kowloon would have been more densely populated as it is now. But even, you know, today when we look at Hong Kong itself, it doesn't take long to walk out from Central or Wan Chai and to start climbing up into the country parks. It's a huge amount of greenery that surrounded quite small, concentrated areas of urban development. And the new territories were, as far as I can understand, just a collection of clan-based villages that were linked by that trails over the hills. When you look at places like, you know, Sha Tin today, these were completely new towns that were built up in the 60s and the 70s. So it was largely rural, I would say. I think it's fair to say. But it was also deforested. It was deforested when the British kind of took the lease of the new territories after 1898. And it was a certain amount of forestry had, I think, recovered by the time of the Japanese occupation. But again, during that period and a period of scarcity of fuel, I think there was another new deforestation that took place. And so much of the lush greenery that we see today, I believe, is a recovery. It's like post-war recovery. As you do ask about the past, but for me, when I first came to Hong Kong, I was actually struck by how much greenery there was. Even now, I think there's so much more greenery than I had ever expected to find when I first came to Hong Kong. And I think a lot of people do find that, especially, you know, when activities such as hiking, you know, is such a common activity in Hong Kong, and you realize that there's so much to explore. And it's easy to see how animals can hide in that amount of space. And I think it's really important that people understand this about Hong Kong today still, because there are species living quietly in Hong Kong, like like the civet cats, and even really rare species like the pangolin, that until very recently, at least, I think Kalduri Farm was still getting information about pangolins in Hong Kong. and that's considered to be one of the most trafficked animals in the world. And perhaps one of the things that protects the pangolins in Hong Kong is that they are, the ones that remain are very, very scarce. So it's not actually worth organizing any sort of poaching expedition because, you know, your return isn't going to be really worthwhile. But perhaps because of factors like that kind of, those kind of historical anomalies that have allowed animals like the pangolins, the barking deer, to quietly exist in Hong Kong.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I think it's I mentioned this in my introduction, but you know, there's always stories. One of the always a favorite story in Hong Kong is when a wild boar intrudes on a neighborhood in Kennytown or hops on the MTR. Everyone talks about the macaques and how they have learned to recognize park and shop and welcome bags. And I guess maybe I'll maybe like kind of end with your thoughts on this. You know, like, again, like Hong Kong is simultaneously like one of the world's most urbanized places, most dense places, but also it's a place where, as you know, a lot of the land is protected country park. There's actually a lot of greenery still. I say still, like much more, I think, than other comparable cities. And so I guess kind of in the process of kind of researching all of these tiger sightings, I mean, were you left with kind of a different view of what it means to be a populated place that kind of juts up against that juts up against wildlife, kind of the interaction between humans and animals?
Yes, I think it does. It does. When you actually start looking at the wildlife that there is now, and you also look at the wildlife that was here. I say here, I'm in the UK, but I think of myself in Hong Kong a lot of the time, really. But the wildlife that was there, and how, you know, the tigers were almost in touching distance of our time. And certainly within the touching distance of older people, the older generations who still live, who were there at the time and who live there now, I think it can't help but make you adjust your understanding of the place and to put things into perspective. You know, take snakes. I think, you know, you at any point in Hong Kong, anywhere you're standing in Hong Kong, you are probably closer to a snake or as close to a snake as you are to a 7-Eleven, which is quite hard to imagine when you think of the 7-Elevens as being the ubiquitous sort of face of the Hong Kong streets. But snakes are just hidden because they do their best not to be seen, but they are all around. Originally, for me, it was the birds that got me interested in Hong Kong because they're the easiest things to notice, especially the big kites. And once you start noticing those birds and you want to know what they are and you start reading up about where they come from and you realize that there's 450 species of birds, including big eagles and raptors, like the imperial eagle that follows the wetland birds down on their migration from Siberia to Hong Kong. Some of them stopping at Hong Kong, others going on from Hong Kong then towards Papua New Guinea, you know, Philippines, Papua New Guinea, maybe Australia, maybe New Zealand, from the Arctic to Antarctic. And Hong Kong is part of this, is part of that chain, and we're not separate, we're not some kind of artificial satellite. We're actually within that whole ecosystem, and I think that's what tigers and macaques and civet cats are a reminder of, for me anyway, and a connection to that, and history actually, but that's another door to open.
So I think with that, that's a great place to end our conversation with John Saiecki, author of The Last Tigers of Hong Kong, True Stories of Big Cats That Stalked Britain's Chinese Colony. John, I actually have two final questions for you, and they are, where can people find your work, and what's next for you? What might your next project be?
The Last Tigers of Hong Kong, I believe, are in the most of the Hong Kong bookstores. book a zine, and also online on the Blacksmith Books website that's run by Pete Sperry, publisher. So that and many other really interesting books about Hong Kong, actually, on Pete's Blacksmith Books website. So pretty easy to get hold of. And next, well, thanks for asking. Well, unfortunately, I did have to leave Hong Kong after more than 20 years of living in Hong Kong. I'm in Yorkshire now, which that's not unfortunate in itself. I'm happy to be here, but I'm looking for something else in Yorkshire. There is a story about a tiger that lived in the town that I'm in called Holmfirth. There was a tiger that was kept by a circus family here in the 1940s, and I was thinking about trying to find out a bit more about that. Apart from that, there's other wildlife like ferrets and things that I'm trying to learn about.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at Nick R.I. Gordon. That's NickRigordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. This podcast is on all favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us continuing to interview those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned to learn more about who's coming up on the show. But before then, John, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much.